Ecclesiastes is noted for its apparent contradictions, and sometimes students of the book have concluded that that's what it is, and that the contradictions never are resolved. I have a different view, and that is that there are apparent contradictions in the book of Ecclesiastes, but that they are resolved if we understand that two questions are being raised here. And one of them is, what is worth everything? What is a man profited for all his labor under the sun? If you take riches as what it's about, that will destroy you. It is not a foundation for life. It is not a foundation for transcendent and real life. But riches should be enjoyed if God gives them to you, Solomon says. And food and clothing and pleasant joys that come to you day by day in an uncertain world, they ought to be enjoyed. He tells us that. And it's a wise individual who enjoys them as gifts of God. But if they're made the foundation of life, if they're made the object and the purpose of life, they will be destructive. Even relationships like a husband and a wife, parents and children, if those relationships are looked upon as being the final purpose and end of life, even they will be corrupted by that, but received each day as a gift of God, and thankfully, gratefully, trying to invest what one has and is blessed within them, they become good. And I want to continue the theme I began yesterday as we think about living wisely in this very uncertain world and taking the gifts of God as they come to us. Today, I want to take note of the fact that Solomon says at the beginning that he tried out wisdom and that didn't get him anywhere, and yet all along through the book he keeps on saying it's better to be wise than a fool. And that to me is again a reconciliation of this idea that wisdom can be made the answer to human problems, and we're talking about the unaided wisdom of man as he seeks to know and understand what life's all about. And then that will be a grave mistake. But wisdom is still good in life, and we ought not to despise it. Let me see if I can illustrate this a bit at the beginning. Chapter 2 in Ecclesiastes, and verse 13. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as far as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, and the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that one event happens to them all. Now that's what he was thinking about as he began. And he was dismayed that in spite of his efforts to be as wise as he could be and by wise insight into life, he was unable to come up with anything except realization that there are things that are crooked and you can't straighten them, and things that are wanting and they cannot even be numbered. That he was not able to penetrate the purposes of God by the use of unaided human wisdom. But he still says that wisdom is good. In chapter 11 and verse 11, of chapter 7 and verse 11, wisdom is as good as an inheritance, yes, more excellent is it for them that see the sun. For wisdom is a defense even as money is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Now, I think here he's talking about life biological and physical rather than life essential, eternal life. I say that with reservation, but that's my impression of it. But what he's saying is it's good to be wise, and it's not good to be a fool in this life of uncertainty. And he adds to that in verse 19, wisdom is the strength of the wise man more than 10 rulers that are in a city. So wisdom he values still, in spite of the fact that it proved to be totally unavailing in his effort to find out what life was about and its purpose as far as God was concerned. Still he praises wisdom. Chapter 8 and verse 1, who is as the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face to shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. Here again he is praising wisdom, even though he had found it to be inadequate to solve life's greatest questions. Chapter 9 and verses 16 through 18, then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the cry of him that rules among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. And so he continues through the book to praise wisdom. There's a section in chapter 10 that is interesting and a bit amusing as he describes the wise man and the fool. Verse 12 of the 10th chapter. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also multiplies words, yet man does not know what shall be, and that which shall be after him, who can tell him? The labor of fools wearies every one of them, for he does not know how to go to the city. That is to say, he doesn't know the way to town. And you can see Solomon is saying, even after having said that by wisdom I was not able to get answers, ultimate answers. And he was humble by that. But still he's saying that wisdom is good. The Proverbs speak about it. The Proverbs of Solomon and those whose words were added to it, these are not absolute statements. The Proverbs are a description of what usually occurs. And they're wise counsel. And the interesting thing about Proverbs is that you can take that book and read every proverb and take it like it is without reference to the context. Sometimes there is no real context. It is just a collection of proverbial statements. You can't do that with Ecclesiastes, although let me tell you there are several proverbial statements in it. And I may look at some of those today that just seem to be there as Solomon gives counsel. Let me begin by treating God seriously as a counsel from Solomon in the 5th chapter. You want to be wise, he said. And he's the one who wrote in Proverbs that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. He says, keep your foot when you go to the house of God. That's another way of saying, watch your step. Don't walk into the presence of God with your head half on. For to draw near to hear is better than to give the sacrifice of fools. Too often we come to speak. We come full of ourselves. When we need to do what we're instructed to do in Habakkuk, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. That is not counsel about how to behave in the meeting house. That is an attitude that you're called upon to have always in the presence of God. You don't know anything in his presence except what he teaches you. And he cannot teach us if we're always running our mouths or racing our own mental engines with things we think. We cannot bring our own agenda to God. I'm preaching a great deal now on the subject of the God who surprises us. And because we didn't anticipate what somebody righteous and good in that absolute way would say or do. That's the reason that Jesus was a shock. This is not the way we would have tried to save the world. And the way God intends to deliver us and to save us is not the way we suspected it would be. And that's the reason that the observation in the 55th chapter of Isaiah is so significant, and Sewell made reference to that yesterday, that his thoughts are not our thoughts. But we have just about come to the conclusion that if we think in our common sense that that is the way things ought to be, that God being a commonsensical God, he thinks just the same way. Well, I want to tell you, he does not. And I don't know why we should suspect that people have lived as long as we have in pride and envy and lust and all the other things that have corrupted us would somehow immediately perceive ahead of time that this is the way God thinks. And this is what he's going to do. And that's a very dangerous thing. The thing we need to do is to come humbly and submissively and say, speak, Lord, your servant hears. Command, and I will obey. Now, in order to do that, though, we have to rid ourselves of ego. And how much that ought to be possible in the presence of the living God, whose mind, whose wisdom, whose power is infinite and so far above us that we have no words even to describe it, and certainly are not able to probe it. So, watch out. Be careful when you come. I think many of us come to assemblies like this. We think of this as the time we come to the house of God. The ancient Jews, of course, came to a place, which is the place where God said he would make his name to dwell. And in our case, we come to a people where God has made his name to dwell. In their hearts and in their lives, he has put his impress upon them. He has redeemed them. They are his. And it's in a living temple that God dwells today. But I think we can make application of this, that when we come into an assembly like this, we need to empty our hearts for a moment of our ways of thinking on just the possibility that we don't have it right. And listen carefully again to what God is saying. And in that way, prevent ourselves from offering the spiritual sacrifices of fools. And such people don't know that they're doing evil. Don't be rash with your mouth. This is his major concern. And let not your heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and you upon the earth. Therefore let your words be few. He's simply saying there that God is God, and you are men. We are human beings. So that when we come, we ought not to speak hastily. Well, how would we do that? Well, we sing these great hymns. And I'm telling you, some of the promises we make in those hymns are really tremendous. And some of the understandings and insights that are contained in the words of those hymns, they are rather profound. And yet we sing because we ought to sing. You know, it's time to sing. Song leader's up there. Let's get to the business. And give no heed to what we're saying. But God is listening. And he will hold us to account. And if we mindlessly say things, either in singing praise to him, exhortations to each other, or in prayer, if we become formalistic, mindlessly formalistic, nonetheless, God is listening. And we are being warned here not to speak without fault. When you vow a vow to God, do not defer to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay that which you vow. Better is it that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not suffer your mouth to cause your flesh to sin, neither say before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hand? I won't take time today to try to explain all of it in that passage, but Solomon's point is, and this is a very foundational point, if you want to be wise at all in this life, then keep your head and watch your mouth when you come into the presence of the living God. Don't make rash statements, and don't make mindless ones. We ought to worship with great seriousness of thought. I said to myself some years ago, and I haven't always kept it, and that's to my great dismay, that I would never go into a period of worship again unprepared and thoughtlessly and thinking about all kinds of other things, but that I would try to focus my heart and my mind upon God and upon what I was singing and on what was being said in the prayers, so that I would not be offering the sacrifice of a fool, some empty head who came to the presence of the living God with his head half on. Well, I think that's a counsel of wisdom. And then in the sixth chapter, we are told, and I've been over this territory already with you, but, you know, we think, and that's sort of the presupposition of men, that riches and long life are by nature something that would be a blessing. But the sixth chapter rather tells us that it's not necessarily that way. And you think that if God loves you, he's going to give you long life and plenty of things. And Solomon said that is not how it works out, because men get a lot of money, and God doesn't give them the power to make use of it. And then he asked this, if a man begat 100 children and lived many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul be not filled with good, and moreover he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than it is better for him to have never been born, never to see the light of day. His life is a total waste. It doesn't make any difference that he had many children and that his bank account was full. And then he even makes it more extreme in verse 6. He said, if he lives 1,000 years, twice told, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to one place. That is a wasted life. I've thought many times about the difference between the Apostle John and John the Baptist, or John's brother James, and the contrast and the way things turned out. And I've thought about I thought about Jeremiah, who lived his life in wretched misery and who had no wife to tell his troubles to because God said you can't marry, and then wound up being carried off to a foreign land where he said God doesn't want you to go, and they took him anyway, and that's where he died probably. And how can God let that happen? Well, that doesn't mean that Jeremiah's life was a failure. I tell you, he was a blazing comet who flashed across the sky. And in no man's life was the Spirit of Christ more obvious than his. And John the Baptist, who died in Herod's prison, was also a life of richness and goodness, and yet it was short. I don't know if John the Baptist ever had any children. I don't know if he was married. No indication of it. I know that Jeremiah didn't have any children. I know that Ezekiel's wife was taken from him by God when he was 34 years old. Maybe he had children, maybe he did not, but the delight of his eyes was taken away from him, and we say, this is a miserable life, and yet God would say, no, it is a good life. For Ezekiel served me well among a captive people who need to understand that the reason you are here is so God can purify your heart, that all this is happening because God cares about you, and he will have a people of humble spirit and purified heart out of all this trouble and distress. But Solomon, I think, is making the point that being full of good things as we think of it in long life is not necessarily a blessing. In this connection, I often think of 119th Psalm, which is a lot to think about. It's a long psalm. But there's a passage in the 60s, verses 67 to 72, that I've read frequently with great edification. We think the best thing that could happen to us is we never have any trouble. Before I was afflicted, the psalmist says, I went astray, but now I observe your word. You are good and do good. Teach me your statutes. What the psalmist is saying, when you afflicted me, when you let me be afflicted, you did good. The proud have forged a lie against me. With my whole heart will I keep your precepts. Their heart is as fat as grease, but I delight in your law. It is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I may learn your statutes. I will tell you, those happy, joyful times are not the times that teach us most. I think it was C.S. Lewis who said that God whispers to us in our pleasures, shouts at us in our pain. And I have learned much from the times in my life when there was anguish. And God got my attention and taught me many good lessons. God uses those things. He chastens us. I'm not saying that chastening is always the kind of chastening being described in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, which seems to be a chastening that comes to us because we are following Christ, because we are suffering for Him. But I know that God uses that. And that being the case, long life, much money, is not necessarily a blessing. Here's another passage I'd give you from the 69th Psalm, verse 22. And I've said already in this study that you need to be careful you don't conclude that because everything's going fine, God is pleased with you. That is not necessarily the case at all. But in this passage, the psalmist says, let their table before them become a snare, and when they are in peace, let it become a trap. What he's saying here is that their riches and the fullness of their life can become their undoing. And it can become ours. It wouldn't surprise me at all that God would sometimes just give a fellow everything. Let him stick his snout right down and all that fine stuff and just gobble himself to destruction. Whereas he might bring suffering to the people he cared about and purify them because of that and make them truly his servants. So don't begin to think that God has abandoned you because you don't have much and because circumstances in your life fraught with illness and disease and heartache. He may love you a great deal. Indeed, I am confident of the fact that he does if you are submitting your heart to him and learning through those adversities. Simple blessings, too, are dealt with in the book of Ecclesiastes. And I think there was a notice from us today. Look at chapter 4, just briefly, where he talks about, in verse 7, "Then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one that is alone, has not a second. Yes, he has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end of all his labor. Neither are his eyes satisfied with riches. For whom, then, says he, do I labor and deprive my soul of good?" This also is vanity. In other words, if somebody doesn't have any children, doesn't have anybody, he just works himself to death, all his lifetime, and has nobody to give it to, and no point to it all. But the idea of singularity, I think, is the solitary life. Verse 9 says, "For two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor." And everybody who has in marriage knows that so. To have someone to share life with, how precious that is. "For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up." I want to warn you, and this is our disposition sometimes, because we've been hurt in a relationship. We've been hurt because we had a friend or we had friends and they disappointed us and hurt us grievously, and we decide the best thing we can do is to withdraw and protect ourselves. And I want to tell you something. That is bad advice. You're trying to save yourself pain by destroying all hope of the joy that comes from relationship with others. Don't let that happen. If Jesus had had that attitude, I think we'd all go to hell. No question in my mind. He made himself vulnerable to us. And we're going to have to make ourselves vulnerable to others as we reach out to them. How in the world would you ever form close ties, rich ties, if you're so fearful of being hurt that you don't risk anything? You'll have to risk. I've said, and I believe it's a true principle, that to love is to suffer. To love is to suffer. And there is no other way. And it's so much better to be with others and to share life with them rather than live in some solitary way. Christians are people for others, by definition. "Again, if two lie together, then they have warmth, but how can one be warm alone? And if a man prevail against him that is alone, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." I thank God for my friends. I don't deserve them, but then I live life by grace, I tell you. I don't deserve them, but God has been good to give them to me, and they have enriched me, and I'm enriched by you. I'm enriched continually by other Christians who show kindness to me, who are patient with me, who hope for better things from me, and believe there's better stuff in me than sometimes I manifest, and help me grow in the grace of the Lord. But close ties with others, so much better than striving for things for no purpose. Relationships are more important than things. Keep that in mind. Practical wisdom, too, is given us here in this latter part, chapter 8. Who is as the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of the thing, he goes on to say. But then in verse 2, "I counsel you, keep the king's command, and that in regard to the oath of God. Do not be hasty to go out of his presence. Do not persist in an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. For the king's word has power, and who may say to him, why do you do this?" Of course, he's talking about a monarchy. And I don't know, the possibility has been raised by commentators on this book that he's addressing this question, all this ungodliness in the world and injustice, maybe we just need to rebel against this whole business and take up revolution as our thing. And he doesn't advise that. In fact, he was saying here, it's not advisable to speak a word against the king because the bird will take that message and carry it to his... Don't speak a word about him anywhere, because a bird will take that and it'll come to his knowledge. And we need to be careful about that. We talk rather freely about things, and sometimes it'll be to our great disadvantage if we're not careful. But he counsels against that kind of revolutionary spirit. He admits in here that there are certain conditions that make a nation sad indeed. When princes are on the ground and when servants are on the horses, he says a country is going to be made to suffer because of that. And then he talks too about a country that has princes that eat in the morning. That is, their only interest is feeding themselves. And they're better. Countries are blessed that have princes that wait to eat and whose concern and interest is in the things of state. And he makes practical observations like that. But he does not counsel you to say, I'm not putting up with this. We're going to have some change. Now, democracy is another story. But I don't know that I have been always wise in the railing I've done against the powers that be. I'm not sure that the Lord is always pleased with me. But I want to make this practical point. Christians can live under the sorriest government imaginable. And they did in the first century. They did in the first century. I know we're dismayed by many things that happen in the public arena in this country. But I want to warn you. If all your energy is taken up railing against that, is that good? What about the things that God has truly called us to do? What about lost souls? What about eternity? I understand the dismay you feel. I felt it myself, and I've sometimes been overwhelmed by it. But that's not the thing that's going to make a difference in eternity. There are no days so dark, someone wrote, that a good man cannot live in them. And I believe that is true. Chapter 10, some more counsel. I think the King James Version says dead flies cause the oil of the apothecary to stink. Perfumer, I guess we could think about the perfumer, the one who makes the perfume, or I guess the sweet oil that was so much a part of that world. And he says that's a comparison I want to use to show you that a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. We have to be careful. Sometimes we take great credit to ourselves that we've done so much good that maybe just this little bit of idiocy won't be bad. And Solomon says, it's very bad. It doesn't take many dead flies in a perfume to make the whole thing smell badly. And for a wise individual, and Solomon is a perfect case, by the way, for one so wise, I don't know if we can call it a little folly, for one who had been so wise and so perceptive and done so much good to do this stupid thing at the end of his life, it was horrific. I tell you, those of us who are older do not have the right to do silly stuff that discourages the hearts of those who look at us for counsel and for example. I think of the Apostle Paul in prison at Rome. What he did in that dire strait in the capital, looking in the face of the Caesar himself with his life on the line, what he did there and his reaction to it was going to be significant across the world as Christians everywhere looked to see what would happen to Paul and what his reaction would be. And his reaction was that I have to tell you that the gospel has been running into the Praetorian Guard, and in spite of the fact that I'm in bondage here, there has been much good to the glory of God. Not despondent, not despairing. And so we ourselves need to be careful when we start talking about bad things. It's a bad time. I don't see how any of us are going to be able to do any good. You talk a lot. You speak like that often enough, and you'll discourage the hearts of some other people who decide, if that fellow's discouraged, then I really ought to be discouraged. If he thinks it's bad, it's really bad. You ever notice at a funeral that the children are doing fine until they look up into the contorted grief of their parents' faces? And then they start weeping too. On the contrary side, there's a story told, I think, about Longfellow being out in the South Seas, and the storm arose, and the boat they were in, and it was a rather dangerous kind of situation, and one of them went to see the captain, and they said, I've seen the captain's face, and all is well. Well, now, when people look at your face, they need to see. And when they look at your example, they need to see the unbroken commitment, not sinlessness, but the unbroken commitment of a heart that wants to do God's will. And remember what a little folly can do. It can destroy influence for years to come that you will never rebuild fully. And what a tragedy, because you could have been such a blessing to others. There is penitence and there is forgiveness, and we thank God for that, all of us do. But how much better it is to avoid it. A wise man's heart is at his left hand, but a fool's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. Yea, also when the fool walks by the way, his understanding fails him, and he says to everyone that he is a fool. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against you, do not leave your place, for gentleness allays great offenses. And there's some more counsel about how you ought to treat the powers that be. Don't jump up and be a smart aleck now, because trouble can come to you as a consequence of that. I have one last thing to say, and no time to say it. Maybe 2 minutes. 2 minutes. And that's about something that you've been wondering when I'd get to. And if I don't get to this, and maybe I'll reserve that for tomorrow. I will. I'll reserve tomorrow talking about this question of be not overmuch righteous and be not overmuch wicked, because I need more time to do that. But the 11th chapter, which concludes all this series on living wisely in an uncertain world, cast your bread upon the waters, for you shall find it after many days. I'm not sure he's talking about generosity toward others, though that's the way this is usually understood. I think what he's saying in this text is, look, you don't know what's going to happen. That's right. But if you don't plant, you're not going to reap. And you don't know whether what you plant is going to come up and produce food or not. But you know this, if you do not invest yourself, because life is so uncertain, you will get nothing. If you watch the wind, you'll never sow. And that's his counsel here. And I leave you with that today, that because life is uncertain, shouldn't cause you not to enjoy life's precious gifts today, and to rejoice in them because of the gifts of God. And because life is uncertain, should not cause you to fail to invest your life and your energies in planting good things. Because in my own experience, I had not planted anything. I wanted to always fruit trees and never planted them because I said I may not be here very long. And I finally decided, if I don't plant some fruit trees, if I stay somewhere a length of time, I never will have any fruit trees. So I just started planting fruit trees. And, it was in Missouri, and they told me after I planted these peach trees, they said you get crop every 7 years, and the trees die every 11, and that's exactly what happened. So, but still, I'm glad I did it. Glad I did it. And even the failures that I've had, when I tried to do good, and the people that disappointed me, I'm glad I did it. And I'm going to keep on doing it. I'm going to throw the seed everywhere. And some of it will come up, and some of it won't. But don't be deterred in your life of investing in life in a godly way just because there's uncertainty here. And I think that's the counsel, Solomon. And that's the end of my address today, and I thank you for listening.